Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, June 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. President Trump signs an executive order canceling the separation of migrant families, but problems not solved.
Depending on where the parents are sent off to, depending on where the children are sent off to, I think they've had to do a lot of this on the fly.
Canada is about to legalize recreational marijuana. Also ahead, the very latest on the hottest new movies to hit U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump reversing his stance Wednesday and ordered an end to the practice of separating children from their parents who enter the U.S. illegally.
We want to keep family together. At the same time, we have to be strong on the border. Otherwise, you'll have millions of people coming up, not thousands like we have now. You'll have millions of people flowing up and just overtaking the country. We're not letting that happen.
But while ending the separations, his executive order indicates conditions for detained illegal immigrants could toughen in other respects. Any adults caught crossing the border illegally, even if to request asylum, will be arrested and charged with criminally illegal activity. Joining us now to discuss is Rob Randhawa, senior counsel with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Thank you for being with us. What's your reaction to the president's executive order that says no more parents will be separated from children?
The executive order is not a good answer to what is the basic underlying problem, which is locking people up at the border who don't necessarily deserve to be locked up. I mean, there are a lot of alternatives to jailing people. The big problem was the fact that adults and children were being separated, parents and children were being separated from each other. This keeps them together, but they're still being jailed. There are a lot of details to be worked out in this executive order, but it looks like their intent is to increase the number of people who are jailed. The language talks about Department of Defense contributing facilities to house people and other agencies to house people and even building new facilities to lock up people. It does theoretically reduce separations of parents from children, but to what extent, I think we still have to wait to see what the details are.
So you actually read some of the executive order?
It's a pretty short document, and there's going to be a lot of details to be worked out in terms of what kind of details the DHS works out on their end, what kind of arrangements they make with the Department of Defense and other agencies for the facilities, and then we have to see what kind of oversight is done to make sure that people's rights are being protected. But the bottom line is that it sounds like they very much want to continue moving in the direction that they moved in a few weeks ago, which is to make all of these cases of unauthorized border crossings into criminal cases.
What about for people seeking asylum?
As far as we know, they're going to be lumped into this. I mean, the executive order did say that if there are cases where families are arriving together, if there's an asylum claim, those kinds of cases can be prioritized, but it can still take a very long time for these cases to get worked out, and you're going to have families detained for quite some time.
As far as the some 2,000 families, what about the children? How will they reunite with their families? Is there a plan in place, and have they kept track? I think there have been some concerns that, you know, people have been separated and moved to other states, and are there records of where people are and how to reconnect them?
That, I think it comes down to a case-by-case situation, where it's just depending on where the parents are sent off to, depending on where the children are sent off to. I think they've had to do a lot of this on the fly, and yeah, I don't know.
Have you heard anything about any kind of oversight as far as ensuring that the children get reunited with their families?
Not a great deal. I mean, in terms of what DHS is doing to see to it, some of these cases are going to drag on in asylum proceedings. Some of them are probably going to have people withdraw their asylum claims, and there's a range of dispositions. And I don't know what the process is for making sure that all these parents and children are reunited.
What, if anything, is your organization doing in response to all that has happened here?
So we are trying to, so we're mobilizing with our more than 200 member organizations to weigh in with Congress. We're going to continue, you know, making the case that this is not a good solution. I mean, we're glad to see there was a response, but we're not going to give him credit for putting out a fire that he created. If the administration is going to start locking up families, there needs to be greatly increased oversight of what the processes are used to detain people, and what kinds of conditions, and you know, what kind and what's being done to meet the needs of these children and their parents.
All right. Well, we appreciate your giving us some perspective on this. That is Rob Rondava, senior counsel with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. But even with President Trump's executive order to stop separating children from their parents, the trauma of the separations could apparently have lifelong consequences. VOA's David Byrd spoke with Alice Lieberman, a professor of social welfare at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, about what's known as ACEs, or adverse child experiences, and their effects on children.
We know from decades and decades of study that early separations cause permanent emotional damage to children, and then later on when they're adults. We know that kids are programmed to grow up the best in the care of an adult parental figure, and that the stress that they are experiencing, because now, I mean, through either the separation from their parents or with their parents, the fear of the unknown and the treatment that they're under is causing a flood of stress hormones, actually both to the parents and children, but let's just keep this to the kids. It's causing a flood of stress hormones that will disrupt, you know, the neural circuits to the brain, create high levels of anxiety. In a normal person, you have a fight-or-flight response that operates when it needs to, but these kids will remain in a permanent state of fight or flight because they can't regulate. I mean, they lose their ability to regulate, and that results later on when they're in school and when they're out in the world, being unable to hold down a job, demonstrating signs of mental illness when in fact they're not mentally ill. They're reacting normally, frankly, to a very abnormal situation.
And this is literally, it changes the structure of the child's brain. It's not something that you could teach them not to do. It's something that it almost predisposes them to do, if I'm understanding you correctly.
These kids who have been under extreme stress actually do, I mean, I'm not a biologist, and I want to point that out, but they do have a smaller hippocampus in the brain, which is, that is the area that governs that fight or flight response. So that's going to be very important going forward, and it's going to impact them for life. Yes.
Is there anything that can be done once that circumstance is in play, or is it just something that they have to learn to live with?
As I understand it, it is like having a big hole in the fabric of your life. You can go on and you can learn coping strategies, and you can learn how to live, but you're always going to be, you're always going to have that hole, and it's always going to be something to overcome. In 2017, the Trump administration ended what was called the Family Case Management Program, which allowed families to be placed in a program as a family together that connected them with a case manager and help them understand the legal proceedings that they were about to get involved in, and help them to apply for asylum and, attend immigration court proceedings and all that. And the program had these people appeared at their court hearings when they had these case managers, and it was a much more humane alternative to these family prisons. It was less costly to the taxpayers. And despite all of that, the administration chose to end the program, and I hope that they can reinstate it because it was a much better alternative.
That's Alice Lieberman, professor of social welfare at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Syria moves troops ahead of a new offensive. The humanitarian crisis is feared as Saudi-led alliances seize Yemen's Hodeidah airport. Eritrea's president promises to send delegation to Ethiopia. And Instagram announces video expansion. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. An unprecedented 68.5 million people were forcibly displaced from their homelands worldwide in 2017, the highest levels of displacement on record, according to a just-released report by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. In 2016, the UN Refugee Agency launched #WithRefugees to petition governments to work together and do their fair share for refugees. But is that message being heeded? VOA's Julie Tabot has more.
There are over 68 million refugees around the world, according to a new report by UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. Spokesperson Chris Boyan says the situation is dire.
There's a person forcibly displaced now every 2 seconds. These are people that are fleeing not by choice, but because they have no choice but to flee if they want to stay alive.
Boyan says driving the worldwide exodus, war, conflict, and persecution.
We've seen new conflicts arise in countries and regions around the world that didn't exist before, but that are driving displacement of human beings in very large numbers now.
Boyan says no one chooses to become a refugee.
And refugees are human beings, just like you and me, who have found themselves in extremely unfortunate circumstances.
But it's easy to lose sight of core humanitarian principles when responding to the refugee crisis. Eskinder Nagash, president and CEO of the U.S. Committee for Refugees, says governments often treat the refugee crisis as a national security issue rather than a humanitarian one.
They don't see them as another human being. They just see them as a burden to society. The governments are actually fearing refugees. When you fear somebody, you don't necessarily welcome them.
Nagash says the modern refugee problem started about 60 years ago when the international community started trying to warehouse refugees.
When you actually keep refugees warehoused for 20, 30, 50, 60 years, that's really a major humanitarian crisis.
But Boyan says it's not a problem that can be dealt with on a country-by-country basis.
This really is a global problem. It's a human problem. And we advocate for all countries to work together to find workable, collective solutions to this collective problem.
Spain recently provided a good example of collective problem solving.
The response that Spain showed over the past week in accepting that ship that was on the high seas, full of very, very desperate people, was an example of humanity, of compassion, and of the right thing to do. It's important to be methodical, and it is important to keep those core principles at the front of our minds in terms of how we want our world to be today, how we want it to look tomorrow for our children and grandchildren. What sort of values are important to us? It's now when these things are being decided.
While the refugee problem is indeed a global crisis, Boyan says it's a manageable one, a crisis that will require the world's courage, leadership, and vision. Julie Tabot, VOA News, Washington.
When Brazilian native Kelly Oliveira signed up for the U.S. Army through a program that offered her citizenship for her service, she thought she'd had it made, but it took 2 years for the Army to work through added background checks. And during that time, she struggled to remain legal. VOA's Eleni Barros reports that Oliveira finally made it through the process and was sworn in as a citizen last week.
Brazilian native Kelly Oliveira is only steps away from achieving a dream she says is 13 years in the making. She signs the papers, she checks in with immigration officials, then the ceremony starts.
Kelly Oliveira.
On a day designated to honor the U.S. flag, a group of 28 people from 18 countries became American citizens at the historic house where the flag that inspired the national anthem was made.
The Constitution and laws
of the United States of America.
The United States of America.
but it was no average naturalization ceremony.
I've always think myself as an American, American by heart, so today was just the day to make it official.
Oliveira enlisted in the Army in March 2016 under the MAVNI program, which promised her citizenship in exchange for service.
It's been a long journey, like 13 years.
Before enlisting, Oliveira had tried other ways to stay legal, but nothing worked.
I went to school and I had my OPT, and I got a teaching position job as a preschool teacher. I tried to get a work visa through the school, but it was very hard because for a work visa you need to have like very special skills, and you know, unfortunately the school where I was working at, they could not offer me that visa.
That's when she heard of the MAVNI program.
I had someone telling me about a program through the military. It's called MAVNI program, in which if you serve, you'll get a citizenship through that program.
In June 2016, the program was shut down, which affected Oliveira's enlistment. The Pentagon, citing national security concerns, ordered intensive background checks on MAVNI service members and recruits. For Oliveira, that meant a two-year wait. She went on training drills and struggled to stay legal. Her friend says it was tough.
I don't think I'd be able to do it. Because it's been a long journey. It's been a struggle. And it's been like a nightmare.
What's the future for Cali now?
The sky's the limit for me. No, it's just the beginning of my new journey. Now I'm going to be going to basic training in a couple of months, and I'm very excited about that too.
Aline Barros, VOA News, Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announcing Wednesday that marijuana will soon be legal nationwide.
We will soon have a new system in place, one that keeps cannabis out of the hands of our kids and keeps profits away from organized crime. Today, I'm also pleased to announce that the new recreational cannabis regime will officially come into force on October 17th of this year.
The declaration comes from after both houses of parliament voted to legalize the drug for recreational use, making Canada the first G7 country to do so and the second in the world following Uruguay. Canadian Minister of Justice Jody Wilson-Raybould said the legislation is transformative.
C-45 marks a wholesale shift in how our country approaches cannabis. It leaves behind a failed model of prohibition, a model that has made organized crime rich and left our young people vulnerable. In its place, we will have a new system that will give adults the opportunity to purchase and consume cannabis legally from authorized suppliers.
The law allows Canada's 10 provinces and 3 territories to set their own regulations regarding the sale and distribution of cannabis. VOA's Victor Beatty talked about it with Nelson Wiseman, professor of political science at the University of Toronto.
This was recommended by a federal commission back in the 1970s when the current prime minister's father was in power, although it wasn't his recommendation. It was a commission led by a judge. It's been debated in Canada, as it has been in the United States, and I'm sure other countries, for a number of decades now. And back in 2013, the current prime minister, who then was not the prime minister, Justin Trudeau, just a member of parliament, not even the leader of the party, he proposed it, legalization. It had been proposed by others, and he's now acted on it. And it was a central feature of the campaign he ran in 2015, in which he was successful and became the leader of the party. And many young people voted for it.
Canada is only the second country in the world to allow the purchase and even the growing of marijuana plants nationwide. Uruguay, the only other one. Why are nations not really jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak?
You know, it's tolerated in a number of countries. All that Canada is doing is legalizing it. And with respect to permitting its growth for personal use, it's very limited. I think it's four plants. Plus, some provinces are opposed to that. Two provinces are fighting that, and I think they're going to fight it in court, Quebec and Manitoba. The provinces are going to be the ones administering it. And while it is the case that Canada is only the second country, if you reflect on the United States, we notice that marijuana has been legal for recreational use in a number of states. I'm thinking of Colorado and Washington. When I was in Colorado, what struck me is that the alternative newspaper had more ads for legal businesses selling recreational marijuana than any other ad, any other type of advertisement. And we've had marijuana being sold in the United States and in Canada, and I suspect in other jurisdictions, for so-called medicinal purposes for a number of years now. What I find ironic is that it was just a few decades ago that we were being told that marijuana was very dangerous to health, and now, the last few years, it's being peddled as being medicinal. In fact, on the Toronto Stock Exchange, one of the sub-indexes is health, as in the United States. And in that sub-index, I think there are five companies, and four of them are marijuana companies.
One of the many upsides, apparently, is the fact that it will take market share away from organized crime. Are there any downsides in your view?
Well, you know, it's being touted as doing that. You know, we'll see. We'll see how it does. I mean, we have a massive organized crime industry in Canada that revolves around tobacco. Because our tobacco products are so heavily taxed, it's estimated a very large percentage of the cigarettes consumed in Canada are brought in illegally from the United States. And so a lot will have to do on costing. And I know the government's done some estimates of what it should cost, and I don't know if they're setting the price, but the idea is to squeeze out organized crime. We will learn as this experiment unfolds, just as Colorado, Washington, and other jurisdictions are learning as time goes by. Canada will also learn. There will be pratfalls. There will be best practices that one province will look to another province, as I think American states are looking to other American states. And we will discover how this thing evolves as time goes by.
All right, that's Nelson Wiseman, professor of political science at the University of Toronto. And turning now to the hottest new summer movies to hit U.S. theaters, we're joined for that by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hi, Jeff. So let's start with the latest Jurassic Park movie, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. So I understand the dinosaurs are loose.
They are. The dinosaurs are loose. This is summer, and we need the ultimate summer blockbuster. We have Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. It takes place 3 years after the last Jurassic World from a couple of years ago, where they actually had the theme park open and all hell broke loose. So all the dinosaurs broke free, attacking the guests. Everyone remembers that, right? So now it's 3 years later, and the park, of course, has been abandoned. Lawsuits everywhere, you know, class action suits. But on that island, Isla Nublar, you have a volcano about to erupt. Now, all the dinosaurs are running free on there. So over the last couple of years, led by Bryce Dallas Howard's character, who ran the park, she's leading an effort to rescue them and put them on a sanctuary island. She's like, we can't let these animals die. And of course, they have to go back to the island to capture 10 or 15 of them to put on this special island. So the first hour of the movie, tremendously exciting. You're on this island. They get Chris Pratt, who goes back with them. Even Jeff Goldblum from the first movie 25 years ago makes cameo appearances in it. And then once they get these animals back on shore, then we find out it turns to a really dark note, and it's all about animal rights because they've been lied to. There is no sanctuary. Somebody's like, I want to sell these creatures. I want to sell them to big game reserves.
Oh,
I want
no.
to sell them for experiments. Yeah, so they're like, you got to be kidding me. Then it turns to a totally different attitude once we get back on the mainland. And I'm telling you, Lori, this was exciting from beginning to end. This was
wow.
the ultimate summer movie. Yeah, I had a great time with it. Oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun. The movie's got thrills and chills. It's got laughs. It is like the ultimate summer movie.
Well, then we've got a true story about John Gotti, the big mob boss.
Yeah,
how is
Travolta
that?
Travolta playing John Gotti in Brooklyn, where Travolta's from. He's really involved with this movie for the last 10 years, working with the Gotti family, because this is based on one of Gotti Jr.'s biography about his father and their family. So this movie has a perspective of the family, of what happened to them, what happened to all those different events. So it's really unique to see this is the Gotti's official version, the family saying, this is what we went through with our father. So the movie really centers on family. Mm-hmm. It centers on his devotion to his children. And remember, he was a mobster, you know? So this is literally like a Goodfellas kind of movie where Travolta speaks to the screen, breaks that fourth wall, and tells you about his life and about what he's done. So it doesn't, I didn't see it glorifying mobsters and all that. I didn't see that at all. You know, the movie's hard-hitting, the movie feels authentic, and the movie doesn't deserve the bashing it's getting online with Rotten Tomatoes coming in at 0%. I think this is one of Travolta's best performances. So I'm one of the few people out there, I think maybe the only critic, who really enjoyed the film to the point where I was on social media, says the movie doesn't deserve this bashing. The Gotti family started contacting me, thanking me and following me on social media. So I guess I really got to love it now.
That's cool. And I would imagine that John Travolta is the perfect person to play John Gotti.
I thought he was. He played a young Gotti, played middle-aged Gotti, and played Gotti dying of cancer in prison.
Wow.
So he plays him throughout his whole spectrum. And he did a brilliant job. I you know, it's not the best film of the year, but you know what? It was entertaining and it was informative. I really liked it. I really did.
All right, let's talk about one more true story documentary about Mr. Rogers.
Yes, I'm Generation X. So I grew up when PBS first started. I was maybe, 6 years old. I had such great memories of him. Every time he'd walk in, I'd have my dad's sweater and my dad's shoes. I would change when he did. And the trolley going to the land of make-believe. I know all the songs still. I haven't forgotten them. But this is a documentary sanctioned by his family and his wife of 90 years old about his life, how the show came about, how he didn't want to talk down to children, dealt with issues of death, of divorce, racism. He addressed all these things that, looking at this documentary, I wonder where I get my morals from. You know, it started with Mr. Rogers and my family. It is such a wonderful documentary. If you were touched by his show like I was, I mean, it brings you to tears two or three times during the film because you're reliving your childhood with Mr. Rogers. It's a wonderful documentary, getting enormous buzz, and I love it.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, find us full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Thanks for joining us here at International Edition. Find us online at VOAnews.com. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent NATO defense ministerial, Secretary of Defense James Mattis observed that threats to our collective security have not waned, whether terrorism to the south or Russia's aggression and hybrid threats to the east. Burden sharing among alliance members has improved since 2014, when only three nations' military spending was at 2% of GDP, noted Secretary Mattis. Last year saw the largest across NATO increase in military spending in a quarter century. In 2018, eight nations are already meeting the 2% pledge benchmark, and more are on track to reach 2% by 2024. In the global fight against ISIS, Secretary Mattis said, we will continue to carry out operations necessary to crush the physical caliphate and prevent a resurgence of ISIS-Daesh. We will be unrelenting in our effort. Working with like-minded nations, we will target ISIS around the world, for this remains a global fight. To support these efforts, NATO is transitioning its current activity in Iraq into a sustainable non-combat training mission. In concert with the new Iraqi government, NATO will capitalize on Iraq's success and reinforce their long-term counterterrorism efforts. In Afghanistan, the security forces continue to improve, said Secretary Mattis. All six Afghan corps are deployed throughout the country, demonstrating Afghan resolve, while the Afghan government pursues a stable and inclusive political order for its people with NATO's support. For nearly 70 years, the NATO alliance has served to uphold the values and the principles on which our democracies were founded, said Secretary Mattis. The American people remain committed to this alliance, and we look forward to working together to sustain our core function, which is the collective defense of our people while fostering peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Washington, this is...